welcome to a special edition of Quest for Gold. I'm Ryan Burrow. I'm fortunate enough to be part of the RIAS Berlin Commission, which is hosting 30 American journalists from around the U.S. here in Germany for a week-long program with stops in Cologne and Munich. So a special Quest for Gold this week. We're live on location from Munich, Germany, specifically the Olympia Swimming Hall at the Olympia Park. This is the exact same spot where Mark Spitz won 7 gold medals for the U.S. The pool is still here. In fact, I'm watching some people swim in it right now, with the towering high dives in the background. The venue at the time sat 7,000 spectators. Today it's down to a more modest 2,000. However, the Olympic-sized pool is open to the public to swim. Just about a 5-minute walk down the trail is the original Olympic Stadium, which to this day still hosts world championship sports competitions and concerts. Yes, this is where Taylor Swift and Bruce Springsteen will perform when they're in town, and was, of course, the home site of the opening ceremonies here in Munich. Many of the venues from 1972 are still well preserved, some with renovations, and the park itself was masterfully designed to coax visitors from around the city and around the world. The area is walkable and bikeable. You're free to move around wherever you want, and you're reminded of the games from 51 years ago by original signage pointing out venues and athletic events. There are tracks, volleyball courts, tennis courts. Anyone's more than welcome to use them. And I had a chance to speak with the CEO of the park about its design, its contemporary uses, and the possibility of future uses as an Olympic venue as Germany considers a potential future bid.
I'm Marion Schöne. I'm the CEO of the Olympic Park here in Munich.
How was this land used prior to the 1972 games?
Yes, it was. Primarily, it was an airfield for military use. At the beginning of the last century, it was an effort also for the Zeppelins. So there was a departure of 2 big Zeppelins here. During the Second World War, it was used for the Luftwaffe. And after that, after the Second World War, it was used until 1948 from the U.S. Army.
Yeah, okay.
And after that time, it was transformed into an airport for general aviation, and it was stopped in 1968 because the bidding was won for the Olympic Games in 1972, and this was the great construction site for the Olympic Park.
There are some great features walking around. I noticed the hill, the stadium. Who kind of inspired that design and the ideas of transforming the space into the Olympics?
The idea was to create a totally different place and totally different Olympic Games as a counterpiece to the Nazi Games in 1936 in Berlin. So the idea behind this was to create here an artificial landscape park. So if you look at the Olympic Hill, it's only 50 meters high, but it's filled with the rubble of the Second World War. So it has a history, really. So, and the landscape should be, the artificial landscape should be symbolizing the landscape here near Munich, the Alps, the mountains, and also you have a small lake, an Olympic lake. And you could find it also in the architecture. If you look at our roof, at our tent-like roof, so you can see at the pillars, so it looks like the peaks of the mountain. So it should be an image that you feel like being in a mountain landscape here. And it was, from the beginning, it was planned to call it really the Green Olympic Games, and I think this was a revolutionary idea in the 70s, and nobody talked about sustainability. So now everybody is talking about this. For me, it's nearly a buzzword.
Sure.
So, and there's a lot of greenwashing. But if you look at this, what they have planned, so to be this counterpart to Berlin 36. So even the venues, so they were put on the earth, or they were put in molds, so that they didn't have had the effect of being monumental, or any military touch should be avoided. So even the policemen didn't wear uniforms. They were put into light blue dresses, so this is, was really, they shouldn't be the cheerful games with short waists. So also an aspect of sustainability, and we have the Olympic village. It's only 200, 300 meters here at the other side of the big street. And this was the village for the athletes. I'm living there.
Oh, so, really? Yes. Okay, very so good.
That's really sustainable, yes.
You want to keep it contemporary so people come and visit. But on the other hand, too, you don't want to lose some of these 1972 images.
Yes. That's really not always easy. So because we have to ask everything when we do a change, we have always asking the authorities who are responsible for the monument protection. Mm-hmm. And we also have to ask the copyright architect. So if you change something, you have to talk to a lot of people and you have to get the allowance to change.
Is the renovations, is that kind of what your biggest challenge is now? Is that that's one of the things you're dealing with? Is there anything specific right now that they're talking about renovating that's a challenge?
Yes, it is a challenge, and we did a lot of renovation because we do the renovation since 2007. Okay. And our stakeholder city of Munich has spent around about 400 million euros for it, and there will be on 200 million on the top for the renovation for the Olympic Stadium. So okay. We will start in October to renovate it, and this is also a challenge to do it during the operating time. So we can use it in the summertime, 6 months, mm-hmm. and in the wintertime when we don't have concerts. So then the work, okay. And we also have works during the summertime, and this will be a challenge in the next years to find here the balance.
There have been some talk about bringing the games back to Germany. Would this location be a prime spot? Do you see this as being a possible viable venue or several venues?
Definitely. So because we would like to show it, it was European Championships last year, mm-hmm. that you can use a 50-year-old or that you can use 50-year-old venues for international sporting events. And it worked. So it worked. And people were really enthusiastic because they said, okay, that's so great. You don't build any white elephants. You use the existing venues. And sure, we had to build in a new track. That's normal. You have to do this. But and some small renovations, but we could use it. And we will build for the Olympic Games, and there are some thinkings about the bidding for Germany for Olympic Games, and I think it will be, so we will put the focus on sustainability, so it's more or less clear that we will have a bidding of 2 or 3 cities, so that we can use all the venues we have here in Germany. We don't have to build new ones, and this will reduce the costs immense. I hope that we can convince the public that it is worth to host another Olympic Games after more than 50 years. Yeah.
I was just so impressed with how poised the German crew were in that first 3 or 4 strokes. It was no hurry, no smash, 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 smash. Just get the boat off the start, nice and clean.
This week we talk with Nikita Moore, a member of the German national rowing team, who's looking to secure a bid for himself for Paris 2024. He gives us some great insight on what training looks like for athletes outside of the United States.
My discipline is the lightweight men's double sculls. This year I was like the last not senior A on the last not senior A level on the U23 and competed with my partner together at the U23 Worlds. Now we're getting into the like big pool of athletes who are trying to qualify for the Olympics, and we have like 2 options. European qualification regatta, which will be next March. After that we have the final Olympic qualification regatta, which is always in Lucerne on the end of April.
Is pressure building?
Yeah, that's, of course, the pressure is high, but to be honest, for us youngsters, it's also a good possibility to still be part of the team.
How did you get into the sport? When did you get into the sport? Have you been doing it since you were a little child?
So in rowing, it's like possible to start relatively late. For example, in Germany, you can start when you are 11 or 12, because before that, it's just not, the boats are too big for like small people. In rowing, it's also no problem like to start when you are 17, 18, 19. For example, in the US, I know that a lot of people only start rowing in high school or in college. I started when I was 13. I did my first competition when I was 16, I think, yeah.
Did you visualize that the Olympics could be a possibility?
So to be honest, when I was 13, 14 and started with rowing, I wasn't really I didn't have a really good figure. I wasn't really muscular and rather very athletic. I would say I was just a small, little bit fat boy. But yeah, though I've never imagined that I can be only start for Germany. And in the first 2 years, I always thought, yeah, maybe I will just do it when I'm 16 and then I have something else to do. The problem with rowing is that in Germany, and I think in the US, it's also a little bit like that, with one exception, that rowing is not the sport which gets a lot of attention from the media. And so in Germany, it's not possible to be a real professional that you get paid by your club or by your country. So it's always an amateur sport. But of course, now when you start international, when you start for Germany, you get a little bit of money from the state or from your region.
Do you train actually in Germany, or do you go overseas or somewhere else in Europe to train?
So I do mostly all of my training in Germany. For example, we only go to Italy in the winter to do high altitude training or to do Nordic skiing. But mostly all of my training camps are also in Germany in the summer. Yeah, I know that for a lot of German rowers, it's always a good possibility to go to an American or an English college and row there, but it's really hard to do the American college rowing and also the German national team rowing. You're you have to decide which one you want. But a lot of people come back from the US sports system back to Germany and then are really competitive there. In the US, you have these two levels where you can compete. You can compete on national team level and also on college level. That's the problem, that in Germany we don't have so much rower that we have the second slightly lower competition.
Is there much of a history with German rowers in the Olympics? Is there a pretty strong tradition?
Of course, yeah. So in the Olympics, and rowing is always a really important event for Germany, especially when Germany was divided. The East Germans, when you look at the medal table from the last Olympics, East Germany is still the most successful country in rowing, even if they don't compete in 35 years. Of course, there's always a dark side with doping and everything. You have to see that. But apart from that, rowing is a really clean sport. But yeah, especially the 8 is a traditional boat where the Germans always want to be really good.
You told me via email that you had a conversation with a rower from Michigan. And yeah, there are some differences between the way the Americans train, or at least the way this person trained, and the way you're training. What did you learn from that conversation?
So I think it all comes a little bit down that the sports system in the US is really based on the college sports and high school sports. And in Germany, nearly everything is based around the clubs. So I also wrote for my university, don't get me wrong, but I train at my club, and normally I also compete for my club. And also when there's national selection, my coach is from my club, then I get international team. So it comes that mostly all of the year I train in my club, and I also compete for my club. And also when we do a national selection, it's mostly about getting into the national team and also to get German champion, of course. But in the US, on the other side, because you have this really big college and university sports system, for a lot of the rowers who come from the US, the NCAAs or the IRAs are the biggest sport event. And then if you want to get to the U23 Worlds, it's like a bonus. This university rowing is mostly centered about the 8. Often the US athletes are really, really good in the big boats, like the 8 and the 4. But sometimes they struggle in the small boats because it's not really the priority. And in Germany, it's or on the other side, we do everything in the small boats, like in the single and in the double or in the pair.
A lot of the American athletes self-fund. A lot of parents spend a lot of money to get their kids into these camps, get them into certain clubs, athletic facilities. Is that very similar in Germany?
So, of course, if you start with rowing or with any other sport and you get into a club, you or your parents have to pay a fee, but it's normally not really high. So I think for my club, it's school students, it's like $60 a year. So it's not really that much. But on the other side, the club pays nearly anything for you. So for example, if you go to the competition, the club pays your entry fee, the club pays your accommodation, maybe even your food. If you get to a national team, then normally the German Sports Federation, the German Olympic Sports Federation, pays a lot of the things.
Do you have a job or do you go out and seek sponsorships?
Because I'm rowing like on a national team level, I get money from the state in North Rhine-Westphalia and also from the German state, so that I can like study, that I can have like a normal life of a student. Not really much, but it's okay, so that I don't have to do another job. Because to be honest, I don't have time between training and university.
I've heard that actually the military is involved with the Olympic athletes quite a bit. Is that something that you've been a part of?
So I thought about it, but it wasn't really a possibility for me. But to explain it, institutions like the military, the police, and the I don't have to say it, maybe the state police. So the border police, they have special jobs for athletes where you do like 1 or 2 or 3 months of like normal normal work or you go to the military university. And the other 9 months you are like you are free to just do your sport, but you get paid whether you will like normally work. For example, if you already want to get to the police, it's a really good possibility because you get like 4 or 5 years where you can just focus on your sport, and after that you get like a normal job as a policeman. In the military, it's not quite so easy. There it's more like you do 1 month per year for the military, and the other 11 you are free to do whatever you want, like not what you whatever want, but like to train. They are called sports soldiers.
In the United States, the Olympics is big. Billions of dollars are invested, commercial advertising, television, sponsorships. I'm kind of interested to know what the feel is around the games among Germans.
Yeah, that's a really hard question. To be honest, we as like people who are in this Olympic sport, we tend to say that the competitional sport and especially the Olympics do not have such a high status in Germany. But to say that, it's not really right. So, of course, we have a big sport funding. But if you compare it, for example, to the US, I've heard that, for example, the University of Texas has like 50% of all the German sports budget, if you take soccer out. I say that a lot of people really care about the Olympics themselves. And the Olympics, they are always shown in the not non-private TV broadcasters channels. So a lot of people watch them. But outside of the Olympics, it's can be really hard. For example, also, I think Munich and Berlin wanted to try to be the host cities for 2028 or 2032. And there were like big votings and most of the people were against it. Yeah, to be honest, I don't know why.
I assume that's something you would support.
Yeah, of course. So I think Munich is really a good city. Last year, there was the European Games. It's in Munich. And on this event, the city of Munich really showed that they are really a big sports city and that they already have most of the venues. I also think that Berlin would be a good city. I know there's a big lot of political talk whether we should try to be a host city for 2036 because it would be like the same year when the Third Reich was in Berlin. But for example, there's also the idea to do the Olympic Games in Germany in the Rhein-Ruhr metropole area. That's where I live. Then you can split it onto like 5 cities, which are all like in 50 kilometers of each other. Where also I think like 30 million people live. I think that's a really good idea, because then you already have most of the facilities. The money which would be getting into this region would really support the public transport and maybe also the real estate market, if they build like new houses and everything for the athletes and for the viewers. So I think it's a really good project. But on the other hand, I can really understand when you look back to the Olympics, for example, in Rio de Janeiro or in Beijing, where like billions of dollars were just wasted for one event. I can understand that some people say that we are not like in the position to do that.
Olympische Spiele in Deutschland? Das gab es zuletzt 1972 in München. Das ist echt lange her.
We continue our discussion about a possible German Olympic bid for 2036 or 2040. I had a chance to speak with Stefan Braus, head of the bidding department at the German National Olympic Committee.
Why is Germany feeling out or potentially seeking a bid now? Is there something unique about the timing of 2036, 2040?
No, not really. There's not really something unique about those years. It's just the case that we got a new board in 2020, at the end of 2020, we got a new board at the German NOC, and they decided in one of their first meetings in beginning of last year that it could be a good idea to go for another bid, as long as this bid is different from the strategy point of view than former bids from Germany has been, because as you might know, we had seven bids after the Olympic Games from Munich 72, which failed on international or on national level at least. And therefore we decided that if we go for a new bid, then this bid has to build up on the learnings from those unsuccessful bids from former times.
You've been holding public forums. What exactly is being presented at these?
We have three goals we aim for. Firstly, we want to inform people that the conditions for bidding have changed completely since the last attempt from Germany. There's a complete new application, a new bidding process created by the IOC, which leads to drastic reduction in bidding costs, for example. And this we have to tell the people in every part of Germany, because nearly every part in Germany was part of a unsuccessful bid in former times. Secondly, we have to provide the people with the information about the guidelines that we from our side have set for a possible bid. For example, that we rely entirely of existing sports infrastructure in Germany, and that we are not going to build any new stadiums or arenas for a bid. And since no city in Germany meets this requirement, you know, not one city in Germany is able to host the Olympic Games without building any new facilities. And therefore, we are thinking in at least clusters of two cities, so to say. So it's not Berlin or Munich. Probably it could be Berlin and Munich, or it could be Hamburg and Berlin and not Hamburg or Berlin. And this is all also new for the people, because the impact of the games is spread across several regions in Germany on the positive side and like cost side on the negative side as well. And the third thing is, certainly we want to enter into the direct dialogue with the people, face-to-face communication. We want to find out before we write a concept, or before we even start thinking about a concept, what is important to the people. What do they expect from possible Olympic and Paralympic Games in Germany? But because at the end of the day, the question for all people is what is in for me?
I believe it was the Hamburg bid 2024 went to referendum and it kind of fell apart. The public just wasn't interested. This might be kind of an American way to pose it, but why do you need the public input? Why not just if a couple cities, if Munich and Berlin want to do this, why don't they just go for it? Why do they need to kind of get everyone's feeling on all of this?
From my point of view, maybe Germany needs a little bit more in this issue, a little bit more the American way of thinking, because probably it's a German or mid-European thing that we first see problems and risks and not the opportunities. And as you mentioned, you already gave the answer to your question. In 2015 and 3 years before, in 2012, the last German bids were stopped by the German society in referendums. And therefore, we have to be aware that our new bid is also pushed to a referendum from the society side. And there is the opportunity to win those referendums, but you only win them if you start the dialogue with the people first, if you explain them where are the benefits from the Olympic Games outside the sports bubble. There are a lot of positive impacts to the society through Olympic Games, but you have to tell them always to the people, because then they vote probably for a bid and not against.
Is the heaviest lift for you to try to drum up national support, local support at the grassroots level, as opposed to worrying about the international support you'd need?
To be honest, I don't know what is heavier, to get the people behind this bid, or to convince the IOC at the end of the day. Because at the end of the day, we have the national level and then we have the international level, and both isn't easy for the time being. Sure. But we know that there are about 65% of the German public are behind our bidding aim for the time being. We try to get this to 70-75%, because you know that this is very important for the IOC as well, because they are always looking on those numbers, how big is the support in the society of possible Olympic host.
The one thing that you may have going for you is that the president of the IOC is from Germany. I don't know if he has publicly supported Germany hosting a Games.
Thomas Bach is German, yes, but he is not really famous to a lot of our people in Germany, because the IOC has not that really good image in Germany. It's not fair, but it is the case. And therefore, maybe it's better that our decision is taken by a new president after Thomas Bach. But he supports, at the end of the day, not this bit, but he said in public in Germany a few months ago that his aim was to give Olympic Games to Germany as he was president of the German NOC. He failed. Then he tried to support Germany as the IOC president, to give Olympic Games to Germany in his term of as IOC president. He failed in this. And now his third goal is that he wants, as long as he lives, he wants to see Olympic Games in Germany. So hopefully this time he is not going to fail again.
Obviously, there's a history of the Olympics in Germany. 1936 was the Nazi Games. 1972, you had the terror attack. Is there a desire to create kind of a new history for German Olympics?
Probably this is an opportunity. You can't go for Olympics 2036 in Germany without thinking on 1936. It's 100 years after the Nazi Games from Berlin and Garmisch-Partenkirchen. Yes, of course, it could be a chance to turn the page. It could be an opportunity to say, to show to the world that Germany has totally changed over the last 100 games, and that it has changed after the games of from Munich 1972, because in 1972 Germany was divided into Eastern and Western Germany, and we are reunited since the end of the 80s. Therefore, it's really an opportunity, 36 or 40, to show the whole world, hey, Germany has changed. Germany is an open-minded, world-open country, like we have shown the last time, probably with the World Cup in 2006, which totally changed the mindset from people all over the world with a view to Germany. They recognize that we are not that what people sometimes think about us, boring, very straight and whatever. But they saw that we are open-minded, that we are good hosts, that we care about our history without putting them all the time in the middle of our thinking.
You're going through these public hearings. What kind of is the timeline coming up here?
As you said, we have now the four different dialogue forums coming up in Munich, in Hamburg, in Düsseldorf, and in Berlin. And we put together all those informations we get there from the public. What do they expect? And we put this in a document, which we will call the guidelines of the German society for a probably German Olympic bid. We will present this document in our general meeting at the beginning of December in Frankfurt. And if then the five cities, and the DOSB will sign a letter of intent that we go the next steps on our way, and then we will start to working on a preferred scenario, so to say, which is the best opportunity for Germany, on the background of the expectation of the society. Maybe they say us go for summer and not for winter. Then we have the legacy to go for summer. Maybe they say, please go really think central or think Germany wide. And therefore, then we will work on a preferred scenario and a rough concept, which we will present in summer next year to the public. And then you will know that Germany is going for a bid with, for example, Munich and Berlin and Düsseldorf for summer Olympics 36 or 40 and whatever. So we will have clear information on this in summer 2024. And then we will see how the public react on this. And then we will, if everything goes right, we will start the continuous dialogue with the IOC someday in 2025.
I'm at Centennial Park in Atlanta, home of the 1996 Olympic Games. This park is open space now, full of monuments, Olympic rings, pools of water, and of course those iconic ringed fountains, which you can hear next to me. There's also a marker about 100 yards away commemorating Richard Jewell, the man described as a hero for saving lives when a pipe bomb exploded during an evening concert here at the Games. You may remember Jewell was falsely accused of planting that bomb. His name was eventually cleared, but only after his reputation and career were ruined. He died in 2007. It's appropriate that we're here at this location because we want to talk about Olympic cities this week. How do bids come to be? How do cities turn into contenders and eventually host cities for the Games? Sometimes it's governments who push for the Games. Sometimes it's corporations. Here in Atlanta, it started with an effort by a real estate lawyer. This week on Quest for Gold, I had a chance to speak with Terrence Burns. He's worked on 13 Olympic bids, including 5 winning bids, among other major sporting events from the World Cup to golf tournaments. I wanted to know what it takes in the current climate to secure an Olympic bid, what's changed over the years, and how cities, nations, and the International Olympic Committee approach the process of an Olympic bid for a Games that could be a decade away.
I'm the owner and chairman of T-Burn Sports Group, LLC. I mainly work in the Olympic world. Bidding is part of it, but also work for Olympic sponsors as well, or companies that want to be sponsors. That's how I got my start, actually, as a sponsor with Delta Airlines before I went to the International Olympic Committee with Meridian Management.
How many Olympic bids have you been a part of, and over how long a time?
Since 2000, the year 2000, me and my ex-partner George Hertler worked on the Beijing 2008 bid. And that was the first one, and we were fortunate enough to be successful in Vancouver, et cetera. So I've worked on, I think, 13 Olympic bid campaigns, 5 of which were successful. I've worked on 2 FIFA World Cup campaigns. Both of those were successful. Golf into the Olympic Games, wrestling into the Olympic Games, just helped modern pentathlon survive to stay in for 2028 with L.A., the entire bid process, and well, certainly what I did for 13 Olympic bids, and most recently LA, serving as their CMO, chief marketing officer, for 2 years. That process is gone.
You sent me the link with a very descriptive, detailed kind of rundown of how 2024.
Did you make it through it?
I did. I got through LA. I got through LA, which initially was a 2024 bid. They ended up getting the 28 games. And I think in one part, you said something that really hit home with me about how the process is kind of like a glacier. You see what's going on the surface. That's what we all see. But what's going on underneath the surface is kind of where all the action is, at least kind of how you're dealing with it. You brought up, I'm fascinated with the kind of the idea of the birth of a city into this movement. Is it a matter of a bunch of really wealthy people coming together and say, hey, we should do this? Is it government that comes, maybe a combination of the two, that says, hey, we really like to do this?
Depends on the type of country, the type of government, the political and social construct. I would say that obviously a bid from China is very different than a bid from the United States. You know, the LA 28 bid was a privately funded bid. Casey Wasserman started it. It's public knowledge. We spent around $50 million U.S., and those were $1 million checks at a time from individuals that Casey knew. And the Olympic Games in the United States will be a purely privately funded affair, except for the United States will pitch in on the security budget. That is 180 degrees from some other countries where it's a national effort with national funding, municipal funding. It just depends. You know, the Atlanta Games is a quixotic story of one guy who got inspired, Billy Payne, supposedly in church, and went around and knew nothing about the Olympics. He just loved them and wanted them in Atlanta, and was an absolutely inexhaustible supply of spirit and campaigning, and went out and convinced the Olympic movement to bring the games to some place, frankly, most of them have never heard of before. It is a inconsistent mix of all of the above, but the further away you are from a liberal Western democracy, the more structured and nationalistic that effort typically is. And funded.
And one of the things that you brought up is you got to create that theme, that tagline, that thing that's going to sell it. And my guess is not only to the international community, but also to the people back at home.
To a degree, yes. At the end of the day, if you have five or six cities competing, there are probably three that are neck and neck in terms of a functional ability to do it. In other words, they all have similar plans, similar venues, similar hotel capacity, similar roads, you know, just all the stuff that you need, all the technical foundation you need to host a summer games. What I kind of figured out early on with help from my partners at the time is this technical process really could use some storytelling. And I think one of the ways that we figured out that we could differentiate our clients' bids was to create a vision that could articulate, and this is crucial, why we were different from the other cities, not from a functional level, but from an emotional level. And then the tricky part is that difference important to the voters, to the Olympic parties? And that's where it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of thought. It's very easy to tell you why Pittsburgh is different from Naples, Italy. That's kind of easy to do. But once you put those two buckets of differences together, you have to start thinking about which one of these differences really matter to the Olympic movement to host an Olympic Games. Because frankly, it's obvious what hosting an Olympic Games will do for a potential host city, for a candidate city. You have to articulate that. You have to get buy-in from the public, especially in liberal Western democracies now. That's more and more important. And really, the bottom line there is it's pretty simple. It's not going to cost you any money to host the Olympic Games. If you can't get past that sentence, you're going to have a hard time in today's environment. So being able to articulate back to the movement, yes, it's going to help our city. It's part of our long-term plan. We're not spending any money. This stuff's already here. The games fit perfectly with the vision of our city in the future. But you also have to buttress that with this is what we can bring to the Olympic movement that's different from the other cities. And this is why we think it's important for you. This is the value proposition for you. You know what the value proposition is for us. Here's the value proposition to the Olympic movement and to sport.
Every city, it's got to be different and unique to that time, right? Like the folks here in Chicago where I'm at can't just, you know, blow off the dust from the 2016 bid and say, okay, we want to submit this now for 2036, right? Different times, different IOC. There's no cookie cutter way to present this.
Not really. So Pyeongchang did try to do that. They bid for the 2010 Winter Games, lost to Vancouver. I worked for Vancouver. They bid for the 2014 Games, lost to Sochi. I worked for Sochi. Then they decided they were going to bid on 2018, and I finally got a call from them. And they were wed, innocently, maybe naively, they were still wed to the story of, we want the Olympic Games to reunite the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, I'm a consultant. I get paid to tell people the truth, baby. Maybe not what they want to hear. But I just said, look, that narrative is already lost two times. So we can debate whether that's a good narrative or a bad narrative. I like math. If you've lost the last two times using that narrative, maybe that's not the right narrative. It being Korea, they were very aggressively protective of that narrative and wanted to argue. And I finally won that argument, and we changed to something called New Horizons, which was about bringing winter sport to Asia. That was a message that kind of resonated with the Olympic movement, with the IOC, with winter sport, simply because it's an untapped market. And winter sport, like in Europe and North America, is kind of plateaued. You know, how much more can it grow? And now with less and less cities being able to host winter sports, that's even being constrained. We didn't even know that back then, you know, All those years ago, 13, 14 years ago. So that is an example where, yeah, you're absolutely right, Ryan. You have to adapt and change. You cannot roll out the same. We're Chicago to bid today. By the way, Chicago had an excellent technical bid, from my opinion. I liked that technical bid. And all due respect, they didn't have a great story. And it was a very American.
Obama and Oprah weren't enough to sell it.
No, that was a very American approach. I watched New York 2012 crash and burn. I watched Chicago 2016 stumble. And when 2024 came around, I was ready to go to work for one of the European cities. They'd already asked me. Yeah, I have a friend. I'd never worked in the U.S. I'd never had a U.S. bid. And I didn't really want one, to be honest with you, because I had watched two bids in the United States Olympic Committee in those days, USOC, now it's the USOPC. I'd kind of watched them stumble and fumble around. And I also knew that there was a pretty strong anti-American sentiment in the movement at the time. So 2024 took some convincing from some of my business partners to actually have a call. The call came from, as you read, the call came from Boston first, who I was there 4 months, I think, and by maybe the second month, it was obvious that that was not going to go well. And I hated to say it, but I said, I told you so. I just knew it's going to be a train wreck. And then I was asked, well, what about L.A.? I said, nah, I just told you it's not going to work with a U.S. bid. Here are the functional problems, systemic problems with the U.S. bid. So they said, yeah. My partner said, let's just have one call with Casey. And I said, all right, I have 10 questions. We'll talk. And you read the post. So it turned out to be a good decision. And it was a really interesting bid to work on and a fun bid to work on. Challenging at times. You saw the messaging that we won on and how we shifted away from a standard USA, USA, land of the free, home of the brave. We didn't talk about any of that stuff. We talked about the United States in honest terms. We were in the middle of a presidential campaign. It was fraught with intrigue with our friends in Paris who were using that campaign against us as evidence of why America shouldn't get the games. And that's when I made the decision, as you read, to use Allison Felix to talk about things other than sport and other than winning Olympic medals and the promise of America, as evidenced through somebody like her and her ancestors.
Sure. And part of it, too, was the fact that a lot of these Olympians are training here, regardless of what country they're from. So there is kind of that base, like the United States is the root system for a lot of these sports in the first place. And
the United States puts a lot of money in training foreign athletes around the world. And some that story's not known. It's not really told. And it's not, I'm not sure it needs to be told, because it's a little hard to do that without sounding self-serving. But it is sure. a selfless commitment to the movement that the United States does and has always done.
What are some of the trends that you see kind of in this moment? Is it environmental? Is it no new construction? You'd mentioned, and there's been probably for a few decades now, this no Olympic movement. Where are they hanging their hat on some of the things that the IOC is really looking for in this Olympic movement moving forward?
You don't need to go back too far to remember bidding periods when there were 5-6 of the biggest countries, cities in the world bidding to host the Olympic Games. The most recent one where they all made it to the finals was the 2012 games, which London won. But you had 5 great cities and they all went through to the final. We all were in Singapore, made presentations in 2005. I was working for Moscow at the time, which may have been the worst Olympic bid I've ever worked on in my life, Moscow 2012, for a plethora of reasons. The Russians did not take that bid seriously. It was a local project run through the sports group in the city of Moscow. I'm not sure where all the money went or if any money was there. But interestingly enough, they recognized my effort and said, we want you to do Sochi 2014. All I knew about Sochi is it was just a little summer resort down on the Black Sea. I didn't even know there were mountains there. And, you know, educated myself, went down. It was kind of an amazing place. Long story short, we did as part of our due diligence, we did a feasibility study on behalf of the Russian government to tell them what it would cost to host the 2014 Winter Games. And we calculated about $12.5 billion. So at the end of the day, they spent maybe, according to media reports, 50. Was it 50? Was it 60? I have no idea. Yeah. It was a hell of a lot more than 12. And sadly, that got twisted around and it became a focal point for cities thinking wrongly, we have to spend $50 billion to host an Olympic game. You know, it was even lost on whether it was summer or winter or whatever. It was just, we read that the Russians spent $50 billion to host the games. We can't afford that. And that became, sadly, the narrative. And it was never effectively rebutted by anybody in the Olympic movement. I think they tried, but that was just a tidal wave of I told you so and negativity. And I think that was happening at a time where, you know, it's kind of like a perfect storm where cities and countries around the world were becoming more cognizant of things like legacy and sustainability for their citizens and their communities. And suddenly the IOC started seeing that bid process being affected by this began with a faux narrative around Russia. Russia did spend that much money. They chose to spend that money. The IOC didn't tell them to spend that money. And it became this backward narrative that the IOC somehow caused them to spend $50 billion. And that's just not true. It just isn't true. But that became a narrative that got traction. And cities began thinning out and backing out. And what's fascinating is when Thomas Bach became president of the IOC in 2013 and created something called the Olympic Agenda 2020 reform process, which is now the Olympic Agenda 2020 plus 5. They canvassed everybody in our business to send in thoughts and ideas on what can we do better. It was a good idea, and it was sincere and well-intended, and I'm sure they got a lot of great ideas. I remember my paper, I sent in a paper, had two things. One was around brand management, and then I wrote about the bid city process, and I knew I was hurting myself. I said, we got to move away from a beauty contest And you've got to move toward a process that is more brand focused. You need to think about where do we want the Olympic Games in 10 years, in 8 years, in 4 years, or whatever it is, and go out to the cities now and start talking with them and helping them prepare so that if and when they become a real bid city or express their desire to bid on the Olympic Games, they're ready. There won't be another virtual bid. There won't be another Sochi. There won't be another, I hate to say it, Rio. There will be cities who are pre-tested, screened. So that was kind of my idea a long, long time ago, along with a lot of other people. And they have moved to the new process that you know now. And I think their goal was to make this thing less expensive for bid cities, to try to create operational efficiencies by changing the rules. I mean, now you can have events all over the country or even in other countries. And 10 years ago, that would have just killed your bid. You know, it had to be one athlete village, everything within X kilometers. And so cities were kind of encouraged to build up infrastructure in places where they may not need it beyond the games, just to win the games. So you've got those operational expenses. And I think they put a much greater real focus on two words, legacy and sustainability. Those are the two most misused words, I think, in probably anywhere, not just the Olympics, but they really, really are focusing on that, Ryan. And, you know, I wrote a line. It's funny when I write lines for bids and then I see them regurgitated later on by the IOC. I take pride in that, even though I don't get credit. I remember for Madrid, I worked for Madrid 2020, and we were presenting in Buenos Aires in 2013. And I had a line that said, "We're not changing our city to fit the Olympic Games. We're making the Olympic Games fit our city." Well, that's become a line and a piece of mantra that the IOC uses now, and I'm glad they do. And the other line I wrote, if you have to build it, then don't. If you don't have it, you know, then don't bid. Or if you do have to build it, you need to make sure that that thing is sustainable and you can use it for many, many years to come. So I think it's just changed to a much more rational, sustainable, thoughtful process. Because I think the IOC also understands that the health of the Olympic brand itself cannot help but be impacted by the cities that they choose to host the games. So if you choose a city to host the Olympic Games and it becomes problematic for whatever reason, that reflects poorly on the brand. That reflects poorly on future cities' interest in hosting the Games because they see something, a problem, negativity that gets amplified everywhere, et cetera. And I think they're not done changing it. You might swing back a little bit toward, as I said, let's pick five or three cities who may want 36 or 40 or 44. Let's screen them, make sure that they're viable candidates. And then maybe we can go back a little bit to the campaign where they're competing and you got a year or whatever it is or two to compete. You know, I think that's good for the Olympic movement. If you've got three or four great cities in the world saying, we want the games, here's why.
I was in Munich a few weeks ago and, you know, the entire S-Bahn system and U-Bahn system was created as a, for the whole downtown because of the Olympics in 72. And they were trying to get away from the thought of the Nazi games, in 36. Obviously they had their own struggles in 72 with the terror attack that happened. I don't mean to make light of it, but you know, it's hard when you're trying to erase, or at least, you know, better your history. And then that happens as well. But I talked to Stephen Brouse. He's helping the German Olympic Committee, kind of been put in charge of these public forums around Germany and getting a sense of how people would feel about bringing games back to Germany. Nothing specific, my understanding from him, Berlin, Munich, Hamburg, anything like that. I think they're just trying to get a feel for if there's an appetite. And my point to him is, no one ever asked me in Chicago what I thought about an LA bid. Like, isn't this, aren't, why ask the public's opinion on this? Aren't they just going to say no?
Well, I think why they're trying is they have two recent examples of where the general public said, no, we don't want the games. They're trying to say, you know, here's the business case for this. It's not going to cost taxpayers any money. It's all upside. The games pay for themselves through broadcast and marketing.
They've got a lot of these venues, right?
And they certainly do. And Germany has a wealth of venues. They could hold, frankly, the games tomorrow if they had to, if they spread it around. It doesn't have to be in Munich. Doesn't have to be in Hamburg. Doesn't have to be in Berlin or Frankfurt. It can be all over the place. And I think what's going on, and I hope it's going on, is an exercise in education about how the Olympics have changed, how the host city contract has changed. You know, that was part of the deal too. The reaction from the public in Scandinavia companies. I work for Stockholm 2026. And we lost to Milan Cortina, which will have the games in 26. In a way, it was a shame. The Swedes were working very, very hard to create an alternative, creative solution to the IOC's host city contract, which cities have to sign if they win the Olympic Games. And there's a specific clause in that host city contract about revenue shortfall. If you don't meet your budget of X billion dollars, don't look at us. It's on you and your citizens. And the risk on that has never been big since Montreal in 76 made a mess of the games. But since then, Olympic organizing committees have done pretty well of not costing their citizens a lot of money. The games budget. Some cities that have won, like Tokyo, decided after they won that they were going to build a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
The non-organizing committee budget blew up. And I think that's another unfortunate reality that people who automatically say we don't want the games are going to cost more money. And they'll say, look, you know, Russia spent $50 billion. Well, that $50 billion, none of that went to the $2.9 billion budget to organize and host the Winter Games for 17 days. They're two different things. And that's a self-funding, typically, exercise and budget. The good thing about a place like, frankly, anywhere in Europe, but Germany, all that infrastructure exists. They don't need more hospitals. They don't need more trains. They don't need more hotels. They don't need more swimming pools. They don't need more venues. That stuff's there. You know, that was part of the LA story that you read about in my piece. It was nice to work on a bid where you had more than enough to consider of where to put things. I mean, we had just a wealth of venues in LA, and Germany's the same. So I think the process that they're going through, and what little I hear about it, I just got an inquiry on it yesterday. I think it's a new story for the International Olympic Committee. I think the games that the Germans historically in the past have said no to, that's not the reality anymore. And they need at least hear what the new reality is, and then they can make up their own mind. I think Germany, my personal opinion, would be a wonderful host, and I only have to look back to how they hosted the FIFA World Cup. And it seems like yesterday, even though, when was that? 06? I can't remember.
06, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My wife is German. I've lived in Germany. I worked in Germany. I've never seen a country's mindset, pride, and character change overnight the way they did. They became very proud of their nation and their country and German flags, you know, in front of homes, kind of like here in America. But that city, that country came alive. They were perfect hosts. The games went off operationally without a hitch. And that's good too, obviously. But I hope that they can draw from that well of goodwill that people might remember from 2006. If I were they, whoever it is who's talking to them, it's a great proof point to use. I think the German nation would make an incredible host for an Olympic Games, and I hope it's sooner rather than later. It's good for the Olympic movement to have a country like Germany, France, etc., you know, host a great summer games. And in Paris, we're all holding our breath and praying that it's going to be brilliant. I'm sure it will, because we need it. You know, coming out of COVID, coming out of three straight games in Asia, and they all did a great job under very hard circumstances, but we need to re-engage the Olympic brand beyond Asia at the moment. And I think coming back to Europe will be a good thing.
We've got more topics to discuss about the games and, of course, the athletes themselves in the coming weeks. I'm Ryan Burrow. We'll talk to you next week on another episode of Quest for Gold.